Hi, welcome to Sistery and oh my gosh, is that Slack notification? Starting again. Hi, welcome to Sistery and Old. We're your sisters and hosts, Sabrina
and Martha.
And on this podcast, we look at history through the eyes of sisterhood.
Very well done.
Thank you.
Did not see that coming.
Oh my gosh.
Right on the third try.
I can accomplish things when I put my mind to it.
Okay, well, Sabrina, welcome back to Sistery Untold. It's been a while.
We need one of those like sound machines that has like applause.
Yeah, I think we could probably add, they can probably do that on Anchor, maybe. We'll see.
That's true.
Anyways, it's been a while. Things have been rough, but here we are.
Yes.
Pulling through.
Yeah.
So we should just, I guess, dive right into our new episode, which I don't have a title for because I forgot that I needed one. So
we don't say the title in the thing anyways, it's just when you submit
okay.
it. Oh my
perfect,
gosh.
Perfect. Well, we'll see if I have a title by then. This episode just might be untitled. The story of Evelyn Nesbit and Edna Goodrich. So, as I just mentioned, Evelyn and Edna are two sisters that we'll be speaking about today. They were kind of icons of fashion, of beauty, of cinema, of film in the like early 1900s, turn of the century, which is the same time period, Sabrina, that you went to that Edwardian picnic.
Mm-hmm.
So like, these are your gals.
Yes.
With both of these women, they were celebrated for their wonderful beauty and their meeting and advancing, I don't know if advancing is the correct word, but like changing beauty ideals for women of their day. So I wanted to start a little bit talking about that before we get into the stories of these women, because you kind of need to have like this background to understand like why their impact was such like a notable one. So beauty ideals vary from culture to culture, but beauty standards play a big role in people's social lives and experiences. The concept of the feminine beauty ideal is basically that the socially constructed notion that physical attractiveness is one of women's most important assets and something all women should strive to achieve and maintain, which is a quote. But I just realized I didn't put down where I got that quote from.
Oh my gosh.
We will circle back to this later. So basically, a quick summary of what is beauty. There are some things that studies have shown to be generally attractive, like symmetry, leg to body ratio, youthfulness, etc. We talked about some of these things in like the episode that we did with Kitty Fisher and Maria Coventry, talking about like makeup. So I'm not going to get like that deep into what makes someone beautiful according to our societal standards, but more so about like what is the impact that beauty ideals have on people and how they change over time. So studies that look into attractiveness and brain activity consistently find that activity in certain parts of the orbital frontal cortex become more active when looking at faces the person finds attractive. So this part of the brain also gets all pumped up when you see smiling faces or responding to statements of morally good actions.
I don't know
if you've heard this before, but of like the halo effect or the beautiful is good effect. But it's like, yeah, so it's how people tend to associate beauty with goodness, making attractive people even more likable. So the assumption is that people who are beautiful have many other positive attributes. And an obvious example of this is like in fairy tales. You know, like the beautiful people are always like the good ones and the evil people are ugly. Or the ugly people are evil. I don't know which came first, the chicken or the ugly.
The chicken or the ugly.
There's some scientific reasoning behind why people think that attractive equals good. For example, the things that people find about women to be generally attractive often can be traced back to fertility and also some evolutionary benefits about health. The suggestion is that facial symmetry, for example, can show genetic health for a family and therefore increase their chances of healthy reproduction. There's also been some studies that show that beautiful people are often found to be happier and have more outgoing traits and better economic benefits. Also, a study done by the University of British Columbia found that personality traits of physically attractive people were identified more positively and more accurately than those who were less physically attractive. It explained that people pay closer attention to those they find beautiful or attractive, and thus perceive attractive individuals with greater distinctive accuracy. So, like, you just pay more attention to pretty people, and then you're like, wow, they're so amazing. But it's just because you're paying more attention to them.
I was literally thinking about this recently because I, like, met someone, and I was like, wow, she's so nice and smart. And I was like, she's just as nice and smart as anyone else. But I was like, she's just really pretty. And, like, I was like, is this, like, okay? Like, I feel like I'm, like, so shallow. But no, I have, like, a biological reason. Or
it's
like, neurological. Yeah.
Yeah. But so, basically, if you're very symmetrical, you have a youthful and fertile-looking body type, you will be perceived as beautiful, and because of our monkey brains, which is the part of your brain that is most fueled by our basic responses to fear, desire, etc., we therefore pay more attention to your positive traits than we do to people that we find less attractive, and so we find you more trustworthy, more virtuous, and just overall a better human being. And then so you get more economic benefits, you get more job opportunities, you get more promotions, you get more opportunities to mate, etc. So then you just have a great life. And I don't know what we can do about that.
So pretty privilege has been with us since we were monkeys, basically.
Yeah, I guess. What a life. Okay, so beauty standards, though, they do change over time, which is great for those of us who lack symmetry or those of us who get told we look tired without makeup on rather than that we look youthful, because beauty standards change all the time. So I've got a little word-for-word reading this article from Science of People, Beauty Standards. See how body types change throughout history. So just some examples are in ancient Egypt, like 1200 BC, the ideal woman was described as slender, narrow shoulders, a high waist, and symmetrical face. A high waist, I don't really know if there's anything you can do.
I guess
about
like
that.
Having like a short torso is what that means.
Yeah. So
and
probably
like
yeah.
And maybe like dress lines would like accentuate that. You know, like Regency style, like really, really high waistlines.
Yeah, I actually don't have a clue what people in, what's it called?
Ancient Egypt.
Yeah, would wear.
I don't know either. I feel like those like Cleopatra movies probably aren't like set on like historical accuracy. So
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but so then moving on, in ancient Greece, which is around like 500 BC, the ideal woman was plump, full-bodied, and light-skinned, which is kind of quite different from what the, like, ancient Egyptians were thinking, so. And in the Italian Renaissance, we're still working with this, like, plump thing. We've got ample bosom, rounded stomach, full hips, and fair skin. Moving into the 1920s, which I know is a big gap, but we're going to talk a bit more about what comes in between in just a minute. So, like, in the 1920s, the ideal woman had a flat chest, a downplayed waist, a short bob hairstyle, and what they say is a boyish figure, but I think they just mean, like, not curvy. But then curves come back into style in the, like, 1930s to 1950s. You got curves, an hourglass figure with a large bosom and a slim waist. And then moving on to, like, the, like, 60s to 80s, kind of, you have, like, willowy, thin, long arms, kind of maybe athletic in the later part of the century. So you have, like, can be, like, more, like, toned and have like a little bit of muscle rather than just being like a like oh.
Like either super skinny or plump, like being like fit.
Yeah.
Interesting.
in the 90s, this is what they call heroin chic, which is waifish, extremely thin, translucent skin, and androgynous. I don't really know how you can get translucent skin. I feel like
just never go outside.
Yeah,
ever.
I feel like it sounds just
and
like
also don't be not white.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
So then kind of in like today's time, we value a more like healthy skinny, which I don't know, is any of it healthy? Who knows? But so like less heroin chic, like extremely thin, but like you can be a little bit more well-rounded, except for your stomach, that should be flat. You should have large bosom and butt, but then still have a thigh gap. So.
Yeah, it's very contradictory. Yeah.
But so that's all kind of like the time periods around the time period that we're going to be talking about today. The period we're going to be focusing on today is like the late Victorian and Edwardian period. And it's the period of the Gibson girl. The Gibson girl was like the personification of like this feminine beauty ideal. And the Gibson girl was invented by Charles Dana Gibson during like a 20-year period that started in the late 19th century, ended in the 20th century in the United States, where he started off by drawing these like pen and ink illustrations. So the Gibson girl image that appeared in the 1890s combined elements of older American images of contemporary female beauty. One was like the voluptuous woman, who was like pre-19th century, who often had many children, did outdoor work, and the emphasis was more on like, not being strong, but like being capable, kind of like, you had to like bear these children, get out there on the farm, do your thing. And the later Victorian ideal, which was of like the fragile lady, who was like not going to be out there working on the farm. She lives in an industrialized world. She's middle class. She wears a corset that makes her waist tiny. She faints at the slightest like shocking event. And so she's very fragile.
Yeah, that's interesting that they like combined that in the Gibson girl, you're saying.
Yeah, so like from the fragile lady, they took like the kind of like slender line. So you still were not going to be like chunky, you're just going to be like really skinny but like slightly less fragile.
And I think, I mean, obviously today we like complain a lot about Photoshop and stuff, but if you look at, because I have some like magazines from like 1900, 1899, like 1901, like that period, and like all of the fashions are like drawn, like you're saying, by pen, and so it's like even more unrealistic, because it's like the waist will be like 20 times smaller than the like bust and like hips. Yeah. And it's like, obviously, like, you know, it's a drawing, so you know, it's like not real, but it's like, I don't know. Like, I don't know, like, psychologically, if it's like how it works compared to like Photoshop, when like people are like making really subtle changes to look like skinnier, like that is also like not good for like your mind. But it's like, this is like this like cartoonish version of a woman who's like, so tiny waist, huge boobs, like so tall, like skinny arms, like because she's a drawing, like she can she can literally
she
do it all.
She literally does not exist.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is a quote from Wikipedia. From the voluptuous woman, she took a large bust and hips, but she was not vulgar or lewd, as previous images of women with large bust and hips had been depicted. So like in the like kind of like Victorian time period, if you were like out there having your curves, you were kind of like not the like classy, you know, you had to be like in that one, you got kind of put in a box. So from this combination emerged the Gibson girl, who was tall, slender, yet with ample bosom, hips, and buttocks. She had an exaggerated S-curved torso, which was a shape achieved by wearing a swan bill corset. So, as we kind of touched on, all of these beauty standards are not just that. They aren't just beauty. They come kind of like with a whole package, which can include personality traits attributed to them and life experiences, and the Gibson girl is no different. The Gibson girl was a middle or upper class. She was calm, she was cool and collected. She rode a bike that symbolized her independence. She was out and about, and not tied strictly to her private sphere, but she also, of course, was not too independent. She didn't support suffrage, which helped her stay in the bounds of respectable femininity.
Yeah, so interesting that this, like, visual ideal had, like, all these, like, moral and, like, personal things,
yeah,
too.
She's still like, you can do this, but not that much. Mm. The Gibson girl, however, also could not be complete without sex appeal. She was sexually dominant, and men were dumbstruck by her, and they would do anything to appease her, no matter how outrageous. Charles Gibson portrayed the girls as, like, in some, like, little, I don't know if they're comics, kind of, with a magnifying glass, like, looking at little men underneath it, or, like, in some of them, like, as crushing men underneath their feet.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
And do you know much about him as a person?
He was... No, I don't.
Okay.
I do have a quote from him, though. This is a quote that was, like, put in a newspaper of the day. I haven't really created a distinctive type. The nation made the type. What Zhang Will calls the melting pot of races has resulted in a certain character. Why should it not also have turned out a certain type of face? They are, beyond question, the loveliest of all their sex. Evolution has selected the best things for preservation as the man and woman have climbed up from the monkey. In the body, as it is always in battle, it has been the fittest which has survived. Men are stronger, braver than the savages from which they sprang. Why should they not be handsomer? Why should women not be beautiful increasingly? Why should it not be the fittest in the form of features as well as in mind and muscle which survives? And where should that fittest be in evidence most strikingly? In the United States, of course, where natural selection has been going on as elsewhere, and where much more than elsewhere, that has been a great variety to choose from. The eventual American woman will be even more beautiful than the women of today. Her claims to that distinction will result from a fine combination of the best points of all those many races which have helped make our population. That quote was a lot. Sometimes I'm like, oh yeah, you go, Charles, and sometimes I'm like, what? Wait a second. Charles?
No, that was, I think that was, like, a really interesting, though, like, because it just, like, exemplifies, like, that link between, like, your character. Like, he's, like, saying, like, oh, like, we evolved to be stronger and better, so, like, of course we evolved to be more attractive. Mm-hmm. Like, that link between, like, the halo effect, kind of, like, I'm sure that term didn't exist back then, but, like, he could sense it, too, you know?
Interesting. Well, so that's the Gibson girl. And we are going to meet now one of the women who inspired the Gibson girl. And her name is Evelyn Nesbit. She was born Florence Evelyn Nesbit on Christmas Day in 1884 or 1885 in a small town of Natrona outside Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Her parents were Winifield Scott Nesbit and Evelyn Florence Nesbit, which is very confusing because... our girl goes by Evelyn Nesbit, even though that's not her name. It's her mother's name. But so from now on, we're going to call our girl Evelyn Nesbit, and we're going to call her mom Mrs. Nesbit, just so we're all
okay. And what was our girl's actual name when she was born?
Florence Evelyn Nesbit, and her mother
was her middle
Evelyn
name.
Florence Nesbit. The whole thing is a drama.
That's so weird. Okay.
So, her father, Winfield, was an attorney who Evelyn was particularly close with. He encouraged her to read and had a large library of books that Evelyn entertained herself with. Her mother was a homemaker, and Evelyn and her mother, they got along for the most part, but from Evelyn's memoir, she describes that her mother did not fully understand her. Unfortunately, though, when Evelyn was 10, her father died suddenly. And this left the family devastated, both emotionally and financially. They spent some time moving around, renting rooms and houses as her mother tried to earn money as a dressmaker. And for some time, her mother rented out rooms in their house to boarders to make ends meet. And Evelyn was tasked with collecting rent from the boarders, as her mother was too soft and often found it hard to ask for money.
Oh, no.
Eventually, the family, Evelyn, her mother, and her younger brother, Howard, moved to Philadelphia in the hopes of finding work. Evelyn and Howard spent time living with their aunt and then some sort of foster family until their mother found work, which she had hopes of becoming like a seamstress or a dress designer, but was unable to find work in either field. She did manage to find work though as a sales clerk at Wanamaker's, which was like a department store back in the day. And from there, she was able to get her kind of 13 or 14, depending on which year she was born, daughter and her 12-year-old son jobs as well, where they worked 12-hour days, six days
so
a
young.
Week. Yes.
Oh my gosh. In a department store.
Yeah, I think they did like kind of like the like behind the scenes stuff, obviously. They weren't out here being like, ma'am, would you like to try this?
Yeah.
But so weirdly enough, according to Evelyn, this is where things started to change. In her memoir, she describes this transition period in her life when the world stopped revolving around her mother and she felt she had more agency in her life. This may just be due to like growing up and entering her teen years, but it also is because around this time is when Evelyn kind of gets discovered. She met an artist called Mrs. Derrick, who asked if she could paint Evelyn. Mrs. Nesbit agreed when she found out that the artist was a woman, and Evelyn sat for her for 5 hours. The excitement of sitting for a portrait, though, was dampened when Evelyn found out just how boring and painful it can be to sit in one position for hours on end.
Mm-hmm.
But she was reinvigorated when she got paid. For this first sitting, she got paid.
Yeah, getting paid for sitting, that's like... pretty good exchange, I guess.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot of, it takes a lot of your time.
And for like a 13-year-old, like there's no way.
Mm.
But she did get paid $1 for her sitting.
Nice.
I'm sure that like back in that day, that was like 20 grand or something. Who knows?
It was not like 20 grand. It was probably like $50 or something. That's still not a lot.
At 13-year-old, okay. If somebody gave me $50 at 13, I would have been like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I'm going to go and buy... I don't know, of a new video game.
I'm actually going to look up how much it actually was because I don't want us to be spreading misinformation. It's like $32.
Yeah, but $32 back then was probably like $70.
Let me say it, Marva. So in 1898, $1 was worth like $32 in today's money, which she was that was roughly around like late 1890s.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is $32 back then was probably like... $100 now.
Maybe, yeah, like in like it's not like proportionate, but still, it's not loads and loads of money.
Evelyn was happy, and I'm happy for her.
Okay, good.
So after this first painting, other artists also became interested and wanted to paint Evelyn. And as they realized that she could earn money for sitting for portraits, Evelyn was able to quit her job at Wanamaker's and sat for several female artists in Philadelphia.
That's so cool. It was all a female artist.
Yeah. Her images were used in illustrations for stories in magazines. So, in 1900, the Nesbit family moved to New York City. Mrs. Nesbit was still trying to secure work in fashion, but was having no luck. Evelyn, however, had letters of introduction from the artist she worked with in Philadelphia, two other artists in New York. One of these letters was a man called Mr. Carroll Beckwith. Mrs. Nesbit took Evelyn to meet him, and he was able to give her work posing for 2 mornings a week, and also gave her more letters of introduction to other artists in the area.
Oh, wow. She's a little career taking off.
A little 14-year-old career woman.
I know. It's 1900. There could be worse careers. She could be in a factory, like, threading needles, like, for, like, 20 hours a day.
So, in New York, Evelyn's star grew. She sat for well-known artists and eventually had a photograph posted in the evening newspaper, and opportunities for modeling for photographers became the next step in her career.
Oh.
The use of photography in magazines and advertisements was a new thing, and Evelyn was in there right at the beginning. She appeared in fashion advertising for a wide variety of products, and she was also showcased on sheet music and souvenir items like beer trays, tobacco cards, pocket mirrors, postcards, and chromolithographs, which could be anything.
Oh, I actually researched chromolithographs a lot recently.
Okay, and what are they?
It was just this like type of printing that uses like kind of like a chemical process instead of like a physical process. So like, I hope I'm explaining this right. So like usually printing, for example, like woodblock printing or like etching and stuff, like you like make like an indentation on something mm-hmm. and then put ink on that and then like put something on top of it and then that image transfers to the paper. And that's like how a lot of printing happens. But chromolithographs were with like, I think it's like a type of like, it's like something with like wax and oil. And so like that like combination of things like makes it transfer like that way instead of making an indentation. I think that's correct.
Okay. Well, it sounds correct to me. So Evelyn was on those yeah. as well.
Yeah. And those have been around since the 18th century. And they're like really cheap and like common way to make things like on mass mm-hmm. as opposed to like other ways. Yeah. Wow. I actually know something for once in my life.
I feel
that's
like I
useful.
See a little bead of sweat on your forehead.
Yeah, the pressure.
So she often also posted in vignettes dressed in various costumes, and these photo postcards were known as mignon, which means sweet and lovely, mm-hmm. as their pictorials were of a suggestive sensuality in contrast to graphic, notorious French postcards of the day. So they were like sensual, but not.
These were more wholesome?
Yeah, they were more wholesome okay. than the French, of course. Mm. Ooh la la.
Yeah, of course. Okay, and so it's 1900. She's like 16, and she's just posing sexily.
She's like 14, 15. She's...
No, yeah, she was born in 1894.
Or 1895. People think that she lied about being born earlier.
Oh, okay.
Whatever, you know.
Either way, she's too young for, like, men to be carrying her around in their tobacco cases and being like, look at this cute little thing. Like, that's weird.
Yeah. Hey, look at this girl. She's keeping my daughter. She also posed for calendars for Prudential Life Insurance, Coca-Cola, and other major corporations. So the thing is, though, that we may have never really heard of Evelyn Nesbit if it wasn't for her work with one artist in particular, whose name is Charles Dana Gibson. As
okay.
we said,
yes.
Charles Gibson was the creator of the iconic Gibson Girl, and he used Evelyn as a model and inspiration for some of his best-known works. She was the model for like probably one of his best-known ones, which was titled The Eternal Question, which was done in 1903. And the portrait features her in profile with her luxurious hair kind of drifting down and making the shape of a question mark. Hmm. I think you definitely will have seen the picture, but we'll post it on our Instagram as well.
I have not seen. What do you mean? Who?
You
who's
definitely
you?
Have. You.
I don't think
Sabrina.
I've seen. Her hair is shaped like a question mark?
I'm gonna WhatsApp to you right now.
I don't think I've seen this, but maybe. But I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not like a literal question mark.
No, but it looks like a question mark. As mm-hmm. much as hair can look like a question mark, it looks like a question mark.
Yeah. Okay.
So the next step in Evelyn's life was from model to actress. Mm. Her popularity continued to grow, and the next logical step in her career was to the stage. Her mother was not super keen on the idea of Evelyn taking to the stage, but opportunities arose, and they were still in a fairly precarious financial situation, so Mrs. Nesbit relented. Evelyn, in her memoirs, considers herself a very level-headed girl who did not fall for the flattery and publicity she received. She credits her father's encouragement to read books as a reason she was able to stay grounded. She, of course, did have aspirations of her own. In her memoir, she wrote, "A healthy girl does most of her dreaming by night. And if I did any dreaming at all in the daytime, it was not of the career that lay ahead of me. A girl's dreams are never practical. And the freakish being to look forward to a life of mending and minding, the ultimate fate of the caste majority of dreamers, is the type of girl yet to be discovered."
Wow.
So she's saying, like, I wasn't like, oh, I'm really desperate to be on the stage, but like, I also was not over here dreaming about my life of mending socks.
Yeah. But I wonder what she means, like, what is a girl's dream? Is that like, your dream is to just like settle down and get married? Or like, when girls dream of being like an actress or something, like,
I think she means, you know, like her dream is, you know, to have like a nice life, but like she's not in it just for like the fame and the popularity. She's like in it for like, you know, getting her family and herself out of poverty, that, you know, mm-hmm. she doesn't want to be doing hard labor for the rest of her life, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So.
You and me both, girl.
Yeah.
I don't want to labor. I just want to vibe.
I just want to vibe. So, I jumped forward a little bit in some things, but where we are in the story now is it's the year 1900. Evelyn is roughly 15 years old, and she's now not only someone to be considered the first supermodel, but she's about to make her first stage debut. What Evelyn does not know is that this next step into the theater is where she will meet Edna Goodrich, a woman who would introduce Evelyn to the people who would change her life forever. So,
dun, dun, dun.
We're going to leave Evelyn there and we're going to meet Edna. Very difficult to research. I could not find much information about her early life whatsoever, so I'm just going to put that out there right now. Edna Goodrich had a very different upbringing than Evelyn. She was born Bessie Edna Stevens on December 22nd, 1883, in Logansport, Indiana, to her parents, Nellie Goodrich and A.S. Stevens. I don't know what his first name is. That's literally, like, there's not that much information about her.
Yeah. Also interesting, so she ended up taking her mom's name, her mom's last name?
Yeah, when, you know, stage name.
Mm. Goodrich isn't, like, a beautiful last name, though.
Let's put it in Stevens.
It's weird. It's more interesting, I guess. Yeah. Like, more memorable.
I mean,
memorable.
It's like, if you were to manifest what you want your life to be, you want it to be good and rich. Therefore,
that's
take
true.
That name.
Mm-hmm.
So, Edna was born into an influential family called the Thorntons. Her family had prominent doctors, lawyers, and businessmen. And she was raised mainly by her great-grandfather, Abner Scott Thornton. And then I'm sure many things happened. I just don't know what they are. Until she was 18, Edna and her mother left Indiana to pursue careers on the stage in New York City.
Both of them?
Yes.
Oh, wow. New lease on life for Mrs. Goodrich.
Gilmore Girls vibes.
Oh, yeah.
In moving to New York City, Edna was taking on the lifestyle of a chorus girl, which the life of a chorus girl was not an easy one. There were long hours of rehearsals, practicing until your feet bled, and stiff competition for roles. Pay for work as a chorus girl would generally not begin until the show opened to the public. And so that left up to 6 weeks of rehearsals that were unpaid.
Oh, no.
Yeah. In shows at the turn of the century, the chorus girls would do 3/4 of all of the stage time, meaning that they did most of the work, but they also, of course, got the least amount of pay. Girls also had to provide their own tights and their own shoes out of their meager earnings.
Oh, gosh.
So this would have been the life that Edna was embarking on in her move to New York City. There was one dream that many women shared that made chorus girl life worth it. And it was the opportunity to find a rich husband.
Okay. I was like, to become a star? I feel like you can't all become famous. But you can't all get married, so that's true.
So whether this was or was not Edna's goal of becoming a chorus girl when she joined, she joined the show The Floridora Girls at the turn of the century, and she was certainly headed in the right direction. The chorus of The Floridora Girls was a sextet of tall, gorgeous damsels clad in pink walking costumes, black picture hats, and carrying frilly parasols, who swished onto the stage and captivated New York for no other reason than they were utterly stunning. Which, again, is a quote from Wikipedia.
Okay.
Each girl was 5'4", and she weighed 130 pounds. Of the original sextet, according to William Andrew Swanberg, who wrote the biography of William Randolph Hearst, who married a chorus girl himself, each member of its original sextet married a millionaire.
Wow. I'm becoming a chorus girl. I'm like 5'4"? I can do this.
Yes. And this would be no different for our girls, Edna and Evelyn. So, the story.
Okay.
This is where things are about to get a little bit crazy. Just want to warn you now. It gets very dark and very shocking. I left out a lot of, like, there's a lot of stuff that, like, if you want to know more information, you are free to research it. I did not include it. So, Evelyn and Edna met while they were both working as Floridoro girls. This was both of their stage debut, and the two became friends and started living the high life. They were rubbing shoulders with New York's elite. Amongst this crew was Stanford White, a wealthy, powerful architect who was famous for building some of Manhattan's iconic buildings. Edna is said to have introduced Evelyn to Stanford at a gathering at White's Manhattan apartment. White went on to invite Edna and Evelyn and another male friend to lunch at his multi-floor apartment on West 24th Street. White's apartment was luxurious and expensive, which Evelyn, from her humble beginnings, found somewhat overwhelming. After lunch, they went up to a room decorated in green where a large red velvet swing was suspended from the ceiling. Evelyn sat on the swing and White pushed her. Although much has happened in her life up until this point, Evelyn in reality is still only 15 or 16, which kind of blew my mind.
Oh my gosh.
As I was writing this and I was like, oh gosh, she's still like teenager.
A teenager, yeah.
Yes.
And like never really went to school or anything. Like she's just like a kid. That's so crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just such a quick turnaround to go from like living in poverty to like hanging out with these, like,
yeah, being in, like, Pennsylvania, like, getting drawn sometimes, and now you're, like, at a multi-floor apartment in New York with, like, millionaires. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Stanford White at this time was 46.
Oh, gosh.
And Evelyn described him as terribly old. White seemed to be a charming, generous man, and he charmed Evelyn's mother and sponsored the family to move into better accommodation. They moved into a suite at the Wellington Hotel, which he also furnished. And White also paid for Evelyn's brother Howard to go to military school near Philadelphia. Not having to worry about money for the first time since her husband died, White encouraged Mrs. Nesbitt to take a trip back to Pennsylvania to visit friends, saying that he would look after Evelyn while she was away.
Oh gosh. He's like getting her super isolated.
Yeah. So while Mrs. Nesbitt was away, White did the exact opposite of look after Evelyn. One evening, he had her over to his apartment and he plied her with champagne until she was basically unconscious. Evelyn did not remember anything the next morning. She only knew that she woke up naked in White's bed.
Oh my gosh.
For years, Evelyn would never tell anyone the truth about what happened with White. And although scarred and traumatized, her family relied on White for their stability. And so Evelyn continued to have a relationship of sorts. I feel like awkward calling it a relationship, but with White for years afterwards.
Was it like a romantic or sexual relationship or just like a patronage kind of relationship?
I don't know. I've read many, many different things. I think that there was, to some extent, some kind of sexual aspect of it, but it wasn't like the main feature of it, because Evelyn did also like date other people kind of like within still
during the same time.
Yeah, within having White in her life. And this is like exactly why it's tricky, because they have this lasting relationship. I've read like different things about Evelyn and her relationship with White. In a BBC article about Evelyn, written in 2015, it describes White as her lover and benefactor. But this is not how Evelyn described their relationship. Evelyn describes their relationship basically as complicated. He introduced her to a new world, helped her family out of poverty, and at times looked after her the way a father would. Having been so close to her father and losing him at such a young age, that dynamic was really important to Evelyn. And yeah, so despite all of his good, he was seriously bad. Years later in her memoir, she says, this is a quote, "White to me is a memory of a great experience. One remembers the earthquake without blaming or condemning the seismic forces that produced that phenomena. White was an earthquake that shattered the foundations, the fabric of innocence." So over the next few years for both Edna and Evelyn, their stars would continue to rise. Both girls left Floridora. Edna went on to meet Nancy Goodwin, a famous comedian of the day, and became the leading lady in his stage performances. Their shows were a huge success, and they toured across the U.S. and Europe. It was Scandal, however, that made Edna into a full-blown celebrity, with her personal life being front-page news. In 1908, Edna had been involved with a millionaire, James H. McMillan, and there was lots of gossip about, like, would they get married and all this kind of stuff, and it was everywhere. Rumors of wedding dates being postponed and troubles in their relationship were getting covered. But Edna confirmed to the press that their engagement was on, and to prove it, she went on a $20,000 shopping spree in Europe with McMillan.
Oh my gosh. Get it, girl.
Her old acting buddy, Nat Goodwin, was not pleased about this, however. He was worried that her getting married would lead to her stopping acting and their show would be finished. So what did he do? He hired private investigators to follow her and track her down across Europe.
Oh my gosh.
He wanted to convince her that her fiancé was not actually rich, so she shouldn't marry him. Edna, however, was always one step ahead, and she hired her own private investigators to track down his private investigators.
Oh my gosh.
But then, in an even more surprising twist, when Edna returned to the U.S., she called off her wedding with McMillan, and she married Goodwin that fall.
Hmm. Goodwin is the one she was working with.
Yeah, the one who was hiring the private investigators to track her down. She came back and she married him.
Interesting.
Who understands the ways of the heart?
I don't, for sure.
But, I mean, this might not just be about her heart, because at her wedding she wore $60,000 worth of jewelry and signed a prenup that said she would be entitled to half of his estate and an income for life should they divorce.
Wow, that's my favorite kind of prenup. Oh my gosh.
Yes, and it was very smart because they went through a highly publicized and very messy divorce just 3 years later.
Oh no. Oh no.
They got divorced in New York City, and the judge said that Nat Goodwin was banned from ever getting married in New York ever again.
Oh my gosh.
So she's doing all right.
Mm-hmm.
For Evelyn, after finishing Floridora Girls, she continued on to other stage shows. During one, she met a man called John Barrymore, who she had a brief relationship with, but her mother did not approve of it because he was not rich. So seeing as Evelyn was, again, actually still a teenager, she was sent to boarding school, sponsored by Stanford White. Mm. She had missed out on much of her education as a child because she was having to work and support her family.
Mm-hmm.
Before going to boarding school, however, Evelyn met Harry Thaw, a millionaire with a railroad fortune who had become quite obsessed with Evelyn even before he knew her. In the year before she went to boarding school, he went to see over 40 of her performances of the same show in 1 year.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. To Evelyn, there were lots of men who were obsessed with her, so she was not that surprised by it.
Dang, that's like a creepy level of obsession though.
Yeah. Harry Kendall Thaw was another very complicated person, and we will get into that a bit later. So, like, just listen to what happens, and then we can talk a bit more about, like, what's really going on here.
Okay.
So, in 1903, Harry convinced Evelyn and her mother to come on a trip with him to Europe. The trip was really hectic, and, like, a lot of tensions rose in the group between, like, Evelyn and Harry and Mrs. Nesbitt. So Mrs. Nesbitt decided to return home early, leaving Evelyn and Harry on their own to travel for the rest of the trip. With Mrs. Nesbitt gone, Harry asked Evelyn to marry him, but she turned him down. Evelyn knew that Harry Thaw had a kind of obsession with purity and chastity, and she did not feel she could to marry him without him knowing her secret. Eventually, after he kept pressing her to marry him, she told Harry the truth about what happened with White. And in another thing that I didn't really like go into at all, Harry Thaw hated Stanford White, like, before any of this happened anyways, for, like, many different reasons that, like, a lot of them were, like, kind of in his head. But with this, he now had something that was, like, real and solid to be like, I hate you. I knew you were bad.
Yeah.
In an even creepier turn, if you didn't think it could get any creepier, for the rest of the trip, Harry Thaw led Evelyn to sites devoted to the cult of virgin martyrdom in Europe. Yes.
That's a really intense obsession with chastity. Oh, my gosh.
And then in, I don't know how you say this, it's French, in Domremy, France, which was the birthplace of Joan of Arc, Thaw wrote in the visitor's book, she would not have been a virgin if Stanford White had been around.
Oh, my gosh.
About Joan
of Arc. That's so weird. I know. That's so weird.
In France.
Yeah. But if other other people are going to see that and be like, who's that?
Yeah. Pourquoi? So, in Austria-Hungary, Thaw took Evelyn to the Gothic Kassenstein Castle, and he locked her in her room, and he beat her with a whip and sexually assaulted her over a two-week period.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Whoa, I did not see that.
Yes, I told you, it just gets worse. I mean, that's from now, it doesn't get worse. Well, actually, it does get worse. But we'll get there.
Oh, my gosh.
So, after this, Harry, of course, was very apologetic.
There's no level of apology for that.
Yeah, I mean, I
agree. Oh, my gosh.
So, when they returned to the U.S., he, you know, was like, I'm so sorry. That was awful. I don't know what happened. I'll never do again. I promise. Will you please just marry me? And he said that after they were married, he would live the life of a Benedictine monk. In 1905, Evelyn did marry him, and Harry Thaw's mother would only approve of the marriage, however, if Evelyn promised to give up acting and modeling, which she agreed to do. The couple then moved in with Harry's very strong-willed mother, and Evelyn's life as the mistress of millions, which is what the newspaper called her, did not end up how she expected at all. Thaw was well known for using drugs and for his temper, and he almost certainly had some severe mental illness since he was a child, but there was no diagnosis or treatment really other than his father like cutting his allowance. And after their marriage, Thaw's obsession with White only grew, and he set out to destroy him. He also, though, was almost certainly experiencing some severe paranoia, and he believed that many people were out to get him, including White, who, according to people close to him, did not even really, think or know about Thaw in the first place. But, in Harry's mind, anything bad would happen, he would be like, it's because of Stanford White. Did this. He didn't get into a club. He'd be like, Stanford White has, told them not to let me in. All kinds of stuff.
So he just has, very, tendency to, fixate on people. That makes sense why he would see her show 40 times. He became just, super obsessed and, couldn't get people off his mind.
Definitely. I didn't think about that, but that's totally true.
Mm-hmm.
So, if things have been crazy enough, things are about to get wild. In 1906, Evelyn and her husband, Harry Thaw, went to see a show at Madison Square Garden. At this performance, Stanford White was also in the audience. And Thaw made several attempts to approach him, but seemed to back down every time before actually reaching him. Until near the end of the show, Thaw finally built up the nerve. He walked up to where White was sitting. He stood about 2 feet behind him, pulled out a pistol, and shot him 3 times in the back and the head, killing him.
In a public place. Yeah, oh my gosh.
During a live performance with hundreds of witnesses.
Oh my gosh.
He was, of course, charged with first-degree murder and sent to jail. The trial was as what the press referred to as the trial of the century, as all of the stars of the day were called to testify. Evelyn, of course, was at the center of the trial, but so was her former chorus gal friend, Edna Goodwin.
Oh.
Edna, however, refused to come to the trial despite receiving many court orders. She was reported as tearing up one of the orders and saying she knew nothing about the affair. After 2 trials, Thaw was found not guilty by reason of insanity, and ultimately the couple divorced, but they didn't divorce until 1915. And in between then, Evelyn had a son who she said that Thaw was the father and then got together on some conjugal visit and she got pregnant, but Thaw said like that he wasn't his son. So,
oh no.
Don't know, but at the time the son was like accepted as being Thaw's child.
Like other people accept, like acknowledge yeah. that. Okay.
Yeah. So Evelyn got back into acting to support her family. After the scandal and divorce, the Thaw family, despite their millions, basically abandoned Evelyn and her son.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. After the divorce, they gave her a one-time payment of $20,000, but Evelyn found that as an insult and despite them, gave the money to, it's not Edna, but guess who? It's somebody we've talked about on the podcast. Sanford White's dead.
That's what my first guess was, but he's dead. Her mom?
No, it's somebody that we've talked about. We've done an episode about this person.
Oh, I don't know.
Anarchist Emma Goldman.
Oh, really? Yeah, I was like, the only other person from this period I could think of is like the anarcho-feminists, but I didn't think they'd be in the same circle. That's crazy. She's like a multimillionaire celebrity, and then Emma Goldman is this like poor anarchist. Like,
yeah.
Interesting.
I feel like Evelyn's, you know, she's been around the block a few times.
Mm hmm.
Started from
Wow, that's so here. Cool. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's just funny.
Mm hmm.
And so, moving on, in the like 19-teen years, both Evelyn and Edna made their debuts in film, rising their stars even higher. As you might imagine, however, Edna, despite her scandalous divorce, found stardom easier than Evelyn. Evelyn could not escape her notoriety, and she was known as the Lethal Beauty, as that's what the press dubbed her. And she married again, but that marriage fell apart very quickly as her husband, Jack Clifford, could not deal with like the public interest in her. And then people also called him Mr. Evelyn Nesbitt. Mm. And that was like in the press and he couldn't take it, so he left.
Oh my gosh.
Evelyn then struggled with drug and alcohol addiction and she made her last film in 1922. And then she opened up a tea shop in New York City that in the 1930s was rumored to be a speakeasy.
Hmm. I wonder if it still exists or like what's there now, like instead of it.
Uh-huh. She then danced in burlesque shows across the country and...
She's like multi-talented.
Yeah. I mean, the girl's been working from like day one. So...
Yeah.
She's picked up a few tricks. Evelyn and Thaw had been somewhat reconciled, and so when he died in 1947, he bequeathed her $10,000. Although, again, this is out of his millions, he still only gave her $10,000.
I know, that's not a lot, yeah.
Evelyn then moved to Los Angeles, and she taught ceramics and sculpting at the Grant Beach School of the Arts and Crafts. She, helpfully for me, published two memoirs, one in 1914 and one in 1934. And in 1955, she was a consultant on the film The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing, which was a very fictionalized version of her life and her experience with Stanford White.
Wow. Dang, that must have been a heavy project to be a part of for her.
Yeah. After Edna's divorce from Nat Goodwin, she continued her acting and also moved into film work. During World War I, she worked as a nurse for the British Army, and her UK home was turned into a convalescence home for soldiers returning from the war. After the war, she returned to the US and went back into both stage and film acting. She never found the same level of success she had with Goodwin, though, and unfortunately also developed an alcohol addiction, and she retired from acting in 1918. Similarly to Evelyn, Edna retired into relative obscurity. From being two of the most famous women in the U.S. and Europe, every move they made being reported on the front page of newspapers, and they were like the precursors for our idea of modern celebrity, they both went on to be basically forgotten. Evelyn died in California on January 17, 1967, at the age of 82, and Edna died on May 26, 1971, age 87, in New York City. Both women lived all of their highest highs and lowest lows from very young ages in the public eye, and people could not get enough of them. Their tragedies were public gossip, and their stories paved the way for the women to come after them. And that is the story of Evelyn Nesbit and Edna Goodrich.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, that was super interesting. I think we both love talking about like early celebrities, and we've talked about before mm-hmm. how it's hard to say like this was the first celebrity, you know, because like so many seem like the first in some way, but I can definitely see how like they, especially with like the advent of like photography, like became a celebrity in like a new way, you know, like if all this drama is happening like and it's being caught on camera too, like, and like information mm-hmm. travels so fast, like you can't really let those moments happen like outside of the public eye.
And I feel like with the photos as well, like having their photos in like newspapers mm-hmm. and stuff, like it's their actual face. It's
like more intimate with the like public.
I feel like it would be easier with like pre-photographs to like you could see someone and maybe not recognize who they are. But I guess
you're like, is that so and so? But now it's like they know it's you. Wow. Yeah, that's so interesting. So was Edna also like a Gibson girl technically?
She's not listed as one of the people who inspired like the Charles Dana Gibson, but she definitely like did, you know, fit into that like beauty standard. Like she dressed and behaved that way kind of thing.
Yeah, it's also interesting that they were all 5'4 and 130 pounds because that's like not super tiny. It's not like really tall and like slender. Mm-hmm. It's not like super skinny. It's not super like it's just like a like average looking person. I feel like that's like so interesting that that was like today, I guess we would consider it like kind of average, but like that was like the goals and like they were like the prettiest ones who all married millionaires. Like, you know, it wasn't like the super extreme thing. I don't know.
Well, I guess it's like, you know, the Rockettes. It's like less strict. I hope so now. I don't think that they have like you have to be this weight exactly. But like, you know, they have like these height requirements and like that kind of stuff to like make everyone look similar.
Look the same.
So I guess if you go with something more extreme, you'll be potentially less likely to find people who like fit into that.
Or like identical. That's true. Wow, super interesting. Super, super sad, like, that Evelyn ended up with, like, two really awful men who, like, were in some ways super caring for her and, like, gave her a life she couldn't otherwise have, but, like, caused just immense trauma. But she really, like, bounced back. Like, I think her life towards the end of her life sounds so nice, like, teaching classes and just, like, living on her own. Like, that's really, really good. She turned it around. She has, like, a lot of – she's super practical, I guess she said, in her own memoir, but also, like, a lot of resilience.
True. I didn't think about that. But, like, she's definitely not, like, a, like, oh, bad things keep happening, and she's like, I'm not a dreamer. I'm out here, like, hustling.
Doing my thing. Well, yeah, thanks for that episode, our first episode back. That was super – great. Yeah, super great one to start with. Yeah, and I know we'll have another episode next week, so I hope you guys are excited. And yeah, Marva, if there's like some of those, you were saying there's some details you didn't want to share, but maybe on the blog you could just put links to like other resources if people do want to learn more.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, we definitely don't want to like trigger anyone too much, but if someone like wants to know more details about their lives.
It's mostly like there. I think I covered most of the things that like are their lives. There's just a lot more information about like Stanford White and what was his deal and Harry Thaw and what was his deal. That like kind of gives context, I guess, but is like is a lot to to go into.
And seems like they're like really scary people.
I think Harry Thaw was very sick and not a great person. So there's that. Do you have anything positive to say, Sabrina, to end on a high note?
Just that, I have, like I mentioned, I have these magazines from this period, so I can post some pictures of those to our Instagram if anyone's interested. I got them in a thrift store a while ago, but they're really cool. There's, like, a few, like, fashion plates on there and just different articles. Like, I got one of them because it was talking about, like, smallpox vaccine. And I thought it was, like, so, like, relevant to today. It was like, why are vaccines real? Like, and talking about that.
Something?
This is a lot later than Montague. Okay. But, yes, she is, yeah, the one who brought inoculation, smallpox inoculation to Europe.
Who we did an episode about.
We did, yes. But, yeah, so I'll post those. And, yeah, definitely any other Gibson Girl photos, you should definitely post them, Marba, because I think they're so, they are, like, so pretty, like, in this really, like, classic way.
Yeah.
And I'm really curious about the ones of them, like, stepping on men and, like, being bigger than men. I didn't know that they were, like, supposed to be, like, sexually dominant over men. That's so interesting.
Yeah, I think they're supposed to be, like, kind of, like, coy, you know? Like, I don't need a man, but I'll take him if I want him. I don't need
him. Which is, like, yeah, a very, like, modern woman in the, like, late 19th century kind of vibe, I feel like. But usually I would think those were, like, condemned and, like, associated with, like, suffragettes and, like, the dangers of, like, an educated woman. But here it's, like, they're, like, highly feminized and, like, idealized. So it's just a really interesting combination. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I will eat my brownies and...
Okay. I'll go eat some lunch.
Call it a day. Thanks for listening.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Are you going to say or am I
going to say it?
I'll say okay.
Ready. Okay.
Okay,
I'm gonna stop recording.